Hello and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. I'm Travis Hornsby, your host, and today we are going to be talking about why the cost of graduate school has not gone up by as much as you think it has. Before we get into the main topic of today's show, I wanted to do a little bit of a unscheduled detour, if you will, just to express my prayers for the people of Ukraine right now. One of the people who's responsible in our team for designing a lot of the tools and resources that you use lives there, and we're trying to check on him to see if he's safe. When I quit my job in 2015 to travel the world and sort of find myself when I was in my mid-20s, I spent a lot of time there, and the people were amazing. The friends I made there were just fantastic, and you could tell that it was a country of people that were just yearning to be free and free from fear and oppression, and that's the exact opposite of what's going on right now with the Russian invasion. So I know that this is a student loan podcast, but we can't ignore things going on in the world either. I just wanted to say, if you know of anyone that's affected, or just if this is something that's on your heart as it is mine, we hope for as good of an outcome and as good of a peaceful outcome as we can possibly hope for right now. So that said, I want to distract us a bit with the many troubles in the world with this podcast episode talking about the cost of grad school, and to reframe your thinking a little bit as to the true cost of your degree, which will hopefully make you feel better about the investment that you made. So I want to talk about the drastic increase in costs for graduate school programs. So I'm just going to give a specific example because we have the statistics readily available from an article that we did. So we looked at the price of dental school increasing over the past 40 years. This is really quite staggering. So the cost of dental school tuition and fees, according to the ADA, American Dental Association, in 1978, for somebody who was an in-state resident, 1978 total fees and tuition, about $3,311. $3,311. Now for a non-resident, it was $4,431. Fast forward to the most recent data they put out, 2020, the average tuition and fees were $55,395 for a resident and $72,219 for a non-resident. So that's roughly 16 times higher. 16 times higher. Here is a little bit of a caveat. So inflation, in terms of prices in the economy, means that the inflation of the dollar would put that at about four times higher. So if you compare the 16x increase of the price of dental school relative to inflation going about 4x, what we can say is relative to inflation, relative to the purchasing power of money, the cost of dental school has gone up by four times, which is a whole lot. And it's pretty difficult too when you consider dentist incomes, because dentist incomes have sort of decreased, you know, even adjusting for inflation because of various reasons. But one of those reasons was insurance companies are paying less. You have like consolidation of insurance providers, and you have increased competition, especially in areas where professionals really enjoy living. So think about your, you know, South Florida, your LA, your New York, you know, the high concentration in Salt Lake City, for example. So you've got a lot of these areas where there's just a ton of competition. You've got a lot of involvement of big dental chains that are pushing down the price and increasing competition as well. And you've also got the good thing of the fact that the dental profession is a lot more diverse and a lot more, you know, open to all different people than 1978. There's a lot of things going on with that statistic. But if you look at other graduate degrees, you actually see a similar cost pattern where there's just been an absolute explosion in the cost of attendance. There's various reasons for that. I would put one reason is that there's increased returns to education relative to not being educated. So if you think about, you know, why do people love treasury bonds? Why do people pile into treasury bonds? Because it's the ultimate risk-free asset. What's the ultimate risk-free asset for your mind? Getting a professional education where the chance of unemployment is almost nil and the prospects of a higher than median income are virtually guaranteed. So think about 1978. Maybe you could go work for a, you know, big car maker in Detroit, get paid union wages with union benefits, and you could just have a high school education and that would work out okay. Whereas now, if you did that, you're going to be subject to a mass amount of insecurity, job insecurity. You have probably a quadruple risk of getting laid off than somebody who's got a professional education. And you don't have a guarantee of a solid income. Even if you had a solid income at a particular factory, you know, say as a steel welder or something like that, that factory could shut down and then you're out of luck. So part of what we're seeing, I think, in the increase of the price of education is schools are essentially, you know, capturing more of that consumer surplus for themselves, to use an economic term. So consumer surplus is basically like the price that something's listed at versus the price that it's worth. Basically, producer surplus is, you know, the amount of cost that the producer would be willing to produce it at versus the price they're able to charge, right? And so there's this interplay between producers and consumers. Well, with education, in a lot of cases, there's a fairly fixed number of producers. That's not entirely the case, but producers have gained more power because consumers of education, people like you, realize that the value of education has gone up, not down. You know, the substitute for education, which is just not getting an education, the value of that, you know, career path, life path, in financial terms at least, has become less attractive. So that's certainly one part of it, is just the availability of opportunities elsewhere and just the security of a professional degree in an uncertain world. One thing I can tell you is if, you know, United States ever became an unfree country, it was an autocracy, they're not going to have a whole lot of use for student loan consultants, but they're going to have a whole lot of use for dentists, physicians, veterinarians, people like that. Maybe I was about to say lawyers, maybe not. Maybe they'd get rid of those. I don't know. It's kind of a scary thought, but it's like you have a security that is almost depression-proof, inflation-proof. You have a skill set that people will need no matter what, even if they're trading food and foodstuffs for your services, which is really a great thing. Okay. Another reason that the cost of education has gone up so much is because the, you know, federal government wanted to expand access to higher education, but they didn't put in place any cost controls. Now, you might say cost controls, well, those just lead to rationing. Well, that's possible, I guess. But what I mean is in 2006, the Grad Plus program came out, and it allowed people to take out unlimited sums without any cap at all. And then Parent Plus came out, and Parent Plus is the backdoor way of unlimited financing for an undergraduate degree of $200,000 that no bank would ever lend to you for. Now, what's interesting is if you look at the history of student loans as reported by the Wall Street Journal, in a lot of cases, the reason why we have uncapped borrowing is because schools, individual schools, lobbied for it really, really hard and got their way. So graduate schools really lobbied hard for these Grad Plus loans that allow people to take out unlimited sums. And if you look at Parent Plus loans, private schools, as well as HBCUs and others, basically said to the Obama administration that they would go out of business if Parent Plus loans were capped at a low level, so they advocated to keep them uncapped. Now, what's happened with both Grad Plus and Parent Plus loans is that the new issuance of these loans has now surpassed, for the first time ever, undergraduate loans, which is really kind of frightening, because that means that trend's going to continue to accelerate. And we're going to have this weird problem of 10 to 20% of student loan borrowers are going to have a mortgage-sized debt on their brains, and then the rest of the student loan borrowers are going to have 20, 30,000. And then maybe a portion will also have 10,000 that are low income, that didn't complete a degree, that the government's just destroying their financial lives by garnishing their wages and their earned income tax credits and wrecking their credit, right? So there's really sort of three different distinct groups of borrowers that you could really say. Now, the other thought that I've got about how the cost of education is going up is just because the schools can. The schools recognize that as long as they have more applicants than seats, they can raise prices and make more money. And they also realize that they can avoid raising prices on undergrad as much, where maybe things like cost of tuition might matter for families evaluating their schools or U.S. News and World Report rankings or something like that. But for graduate schools, it's just this big slush fund that they can continue to raise prices and people stay enrolled and they don't drop out, primarily because there's just no option to. If you've got $100,000 of debt from vet school or dental school or med school or something after your first year or 2 years, you're staying. There's very few scenarios where you're going to drop out no matter what the reason, right? So they basically have a captive consumer with no regulatory protection at all for that consumer. In one case, the University of Washington Dental School was basically mismanaged and run very poorly. and made up for all their financial mistakes by tripling the tuition charged to the students over a very short amount of time. And there's nothing preventing schools from doing things like this because, again, if you are a for-profit school, you get attacked by people on the left. If you're a not-for-profit school, you maybe get attacked from people on the right, but nobody, at least there's no bipartisan interest in representing students and keeping costs in check, no matter what is going on with what type of institution you are. Anyways, let's think about other ways the prices of education has gone up. So it's not just the cost in individual programs. It's also the kind of programs and the kind of university programs that have proliferated. So think about physical therapy, a profession where for a long time people had a master's degree program, and that was okay. You learned what you needed to learn in your master's program, and you got to work. But then the accrediting agencies and the universities and the powers that be in the profession got this great idea that they could force everyone to get a DPT, a doctorate degree, which means more time in school and lost earnings from working. And they did that because it made them more money. Now you might say, oh, there's extra education or extra things you learn. Let's be honest, they just wanted more money and they could, and so they turned the screws to get it. That's one way costs have gone up is, you could say, sort of credential inflation or degree inflation. Another way is the type of programs that have opened up. So if you have a new med school or dental school or physical therapy program, pharmacy program, vet school, whatever, it tends to not be a low-cost in-state public institution that gets opened. It tends to be a high-cost private or even for-profit institution that gets created because the people that are making it realize it's a great revenue opportunity. So your, you know, new seats that have opened up for med schools have disproportionately been private DO programs, right, or private schools, or even for-profit schools or Caribbean schools. These are the types of institutions that have opened seats disproportionately compared to your, you know, lower cost in-state med schools that have kept the same sort of rough limits on the number of seats. And in medicine specifically, there's a little bit more of a protection for people in terms of the demand for services because of the cap on residency spots. So Medicare funds residency spots. Hospitals really don't like creating extra ones that they fund. So the number of residency spots has stayed roughly constant, and that puts a cap on the number of new programs that can get created because it's really bad to have somebody go through medical school and then not match. That'd be considered a failure of a program if a lot of people had that experience, right? But you don't have that constraint for things like pharmacy school, vet med, law school, et cetera. So for law schools, think about this. The last financial crisis is when, in 2008, is when the glut of law schools was exposed. There was a big contraction of interest in the profession because people felt like there was just way too many lawyers being produced. There was a bunch of coverage in the Wall Street Journal about things schools were doing that were dishonest, like inflating their employment numbers by like having somebody hired on by the law school library to try to protect their rankings, and just a bunch of shady things. So there was a little bit of a contraction there, but not because of the cost. It was really because of the job market. That's what slowed things down. Now, if you think about pharmacy, pharmacists were facing a job crisis before the pandemic. That's what is so crazy to think about is pharmacy was headed towards an 85% acceptance rate. For, in other words, 85% of people that applied to pharmacy school got in. And it used to be 30% or so. Over the past two decades, so many new pharmacy programs have opened up that the demand wasn't for students to go. It was just almost the same as the number of seats offered. And that was just really causing a lot of schools to pressure people into doing things like early decision and all kinds of stuff. And there was problems with like people not being able to get any full-time positions. And then the pandemic happened and then demand for pharmacists exploded. And who knows what happens long term? Do we get back in 5 years? Are we back to the same problem with pharmacist jobs really not being that abundant? Well, who knows? Same thing with vet med. Vet med pre-pandemic was solid. You know, there wasn't a problem with people getting hired or anything. But during and post-pandemic, the amount of money that people had soared because of things like not being able to go out to spend it anywhere else during a pandemic and pandemic stimulus relief programs and things, and also just being stuck indoors looking at your pets all day, thinking of things you can do to help the pets. So consumer discretionary spending was a lot more freed up. A lot of people spent that money on getting a pet or spending it on their pets. And so the demand for veterinarians soared during the pandemic. So a lot of these things, it's like, how can you predict the future, right? In terms of what the cost dynamics are going to be. You know, business school, interest in business school has declined a lot for top 100 programs. You know, I think I recall some article that talked about University of Iowa ending its MBA program for the state, which is sort of a thing that you wouldn't really expect. But the value of a master of different master's degrees in places where people are expecting a quick, straightforward payoff and that they're not getting, that's putting pressure on some of these programs that I would say are sort of not absolutely required to do the profession. And if you think about like where law schools get in trouble, it's producing lawyers that have law degrees, but then they work in jobs that don't require a law degree. And, you know, same thing for business school. You go to business school, spend all this money on an MBA, and then end up in a degree, in a program or a job that you could have gotten without the MBA, right? Whereas you can't really have the same thing happen for, you know, physical therapy or pharmacists or physicians, right? You kind of expect you're going to get employed in that field pretty directly with the degree that you have. I claimed in this episode that the cost of school is gone up, but not nearly as much as you think. So why would I say something like that? The answer is that you have to look for cost of education. You have to look at the present value of the payments you're making. So what is present value? Let's talk about that first. Say you make a stream of payments over 1 year, 10 years, 20 years, doesn't matter. What you want to do is figure out what is that worth in today's dollars. So you pick an interest rate that reflects a reasonable rate of return, and you use a formula that converts those stream of payments into today's dollars. Okay, so that stream of payments into today's dollars, that represents the true cost of what you're actually paying. So first off, for those pursuing 20-year pay-as-you-earn or 25-year repay IBR, there's a tax bomb, but we're almost sure that tax bomb's not going to happen because politically, there's just too many reasons why they would want to get rid of it when it actually ends up being charged. So that's going to be something, you know, that you probably won't have to deal with. So you want to think about that when you're thinking about the cost in terms of today's dollars that you'd pay on an IBR plan over 20 or 25 years. The cost overall has soared. However, the cost to you might not have increased by nearly as much. Okay. If you're paying full cost, like out of pocket, you know, if you're paying out of cost for your degree program, then you're experiencing the full increase of the cost of education. But a typical degree program, you might have 80% of people take out at least some loans and 20% of people pay out of pocket. Now, if you go to a lower cost program, if you borrow about the same amount of debt as you're expecting you'll earn in your first year making a full salary, then that you're also facing the full cost of the educational increase. You're paying that out of pocket. You know, you're going to pay that back at least out of pocket. So if you're just borrowing about one times your salary, forgiveness is basically a mathematical impossibility, which means that, you know, if you refinance, you can get the cost a little bit lower, but you're still going to be paying a whole lot. Now, what happens if you borrow double your income in student debt or more? Let's say you borrowed $400,000 as a dentist, and let's say you earn $120,000 as an associate starting out, and that grows to $230,000 as a practice owner. So without any optimizations or tricks at all, if you look at the cost of the payments you'll pay back on pay-as-you-earn in today's dollars, you will pay back roughly half of that $400,000. So again, we're just looking at you borrowed $400,000, the government paid $400,000 up front. How much will you pay back the government? The rough guesstimate I've got for you, if you're the typical above average person that starts out as an associate and becomes a practice owner, the typical guess that I would have would be that you'd pay back about half of what you borrowed. Again, we're pretty sure that the tax bomb's not going to end up happening. If you add in the tax bomb, then maybe that's like you pay back instead of half, maybe you're paying back 60 to 70%. What if you did some optimizations? What if you worked with a student loan planner and did things like looked at buying your building for your practice and looked at your 401k plan and thought about, hey, how can I reduce my AGI? Maybe I've got a spouse that I could do a spousal IRA for. Maybe we could maximize, you know, things like the married filing separately benefits in a community property state, you know, like Texas or California. Maybe there's other things you haven't thought about, like getting involved in real estate, or maybe you own the practice equipment and building and you can depreciate it and lower your AGI that way. Maybe you can set up a profit sharing plan and use that to put away even more than $20,500 with a small employer match for retirement. So there's all these different things that you could potentially do to lower your taxable income, to lower your AGI. If you do all those things, instead of paying back 50% of what you borrowed in today's dollars, you would lower that to around 35% to 40% of what you borrowed in today's dollars. So in other words, if you borrowed at 400, right, and you're earning, you know, as a practice owner about 230 or something like that, then I'm projecting you'd pay back about 200,000 in today's dollars. If you look at the stream of 20 years worth of payments under pay as you earn, that's what I mean. And if you optimize things and make some smart decisions, maybe you could get that down to 160,000 in today's dollars. So what if you went to NYU Dental and borrowed 700,000 instead of 400? Well, the cost is exactly the same for that degree as it was the 400K degree because it's only based off of what you earn. So assuming you earn about the same amount of money, then in that case, you would only pay back about 20% of what you borrowed. So to go back to that early example where the cost of dental school went up 16x and the price of inflation went up 4x. So the relative price back in 1978 was a lot cheaper. Well, actually, think about this. Dental school, basically, if you adjust for inflation, went up 4x. But if you're only paying 20% of the cost because you went to NYU, then that means, you know, you're paying 1/5 of the cost. And, you know, you're, we'll get to this, but, you know, the government's paying the other 4/5. So what's 4 times 1/5? Because you're paying back 20%. I'm doing a lot of math on this program, so, you know, fast forward this if this is too much, but 4 times 1/5 is 4/5, which means that the student that's going for a aggressive IBR type of program that borrowed $700,000 to attend NYU Dental is actually paying back only 80% of what someone that went to NYU Dental in 1978 paid. Pretty mind-blowing, right? Where in fact, even though the price of dental school is absolutely soared, in terms of purchasing power, you can actually make an argument for the highest cost programs that are just the most expensive, and you're looking at, you know, the cost based off of just what you're earning. So you could make a case that the cost of some of these programs in actual effective terms is even cheaper than the super cheap cost that it was if you fully optimize everything in terms of today's dollars, which is really crazy. Now, if you did even more aggressive optimizations, right, you live in a community property state, you get super involved in real estate and you have a spouse that's a professional real estate investor, you start a profit sharing plan to lower your AGI substantially, maybe you could get that cost to you in today's dollars of your education down even lower, and maybe you could pay 1970s prices for your education too. So what does that even mean? Well, basically the people who are optimizing everything with income-based options are getting prices that are like from the 1970s, 1980s, that are rock bottom prices, and you're offloading all of the cost onto the taxpayer slash the government. And guess what? You are a taxpayer, obviously, so you're paying for it too indirectly, but we'll talk about that in a second. Other professions where you're paying back, in many cases, a fraction of what you borrowed, vet med, chiropractic, physical therapy in some cases, occupational therapy in some cases, you know, to a lesser extent, PAs, NPs, depends on your school, but some lawyers. In professions with the highest debt-to-income ratios, the amount you pay back as a percent of the actual amount you're borrowing could be as low as 10 to 30% if you know what you're doing. And the rest is paid for by the government. Indirectly, because they paid up front, you pay them back. And any balance that you're not paying is getting paid through the government. So what about med school and PSLF? We know that a majority of physicians should be able to get PSLF. Let's say you're a brain surgeon and you do a 7-year residency and you make $600,000 a year when you get out of residency. And let's say you borrowed, you know, $300,000, half of your expected income when you graduate. So 7-year residency means this. When you graduate, you can use your prior year tax return that gives you a $0 AGI. So your first year out, you get $0 payments. Second year out, you're using your tax return that only shows half of the income as a resident that you have because you start residency in the summer. And so you're only earning income for half the year. So the second year of your repayment, maybe you're paying $100 a month or some nominal amount. So first 2 years of residency, you're paying almost nothing. And this is the case for basically all physicians. And the third year payments, they find out about your $60,000, $70,000 a year income. So maybe you're paying $300 a month. So you're paying $300 a month and you're paying that until they find out about your higher income. But your first year out as an attending, you're probably reporting income for half of the year, or in many cases, you might start in September, right? Or, you know, August or September after you finish residency or fellowship. So you might have a payment that jumps from $300 to like $1,500 a month. And then finally, for the final year, you know, of payments on the 10-year PSLF, for one single year, you're paying as an attending, paying $3,000 or $4,000 a month. So if you kind of run the math, you know, you might pay back in today's dollars about $65,000 of your $300K you borrowed because your training length for this specialist example is so long. Now, we need brain surgeons, we need physicians, we need every single profession I talk about on this podcast. I'm not so much saying what should be as what is and how it can affect your perspective of the value of your education, which is way higher than you think it is. There are even changes that are possibly coming to how residency deferment might end up being counted for PSLF one day. There's a chance with regulatory rules being discussed right now that you'll be able to just defer in residency and have that count for PSLF, which means you could pay even less. And if that happened, instead of paying about 60-something thousand back in today's dollars, you'd pay even less. Now, consider this. Now, this is an interesting thing to note, because I think if more populist type of people knew this information, they'd be probably pretty upset. And it doesn't matter, because it doesn't matter what people think. You just use the rules as they're written and just, you can't control it. So you might as well benefit from it however it happens, right? Think about this. Pretend you became an attending in, let's say, 2019. Well, your payments are based on residency, so you're paying $300 a month, right? And then COVID happened. And you were supposed to recertify with your 2019 income, but because COVID happened, they put that on pause. And so then we've had 2 years worth of paused payments from COVID. And we've just had an announcement that people with recertification dates before November 2022 will have that payment kicked out till 2023. So from 2019 to 2023, a lot of people that became attendings in the late 20-teens will be able to pay, you know, $0 to $300 a month for 4 years when they were supposed to be paying $1,000, $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 a month. You know, I've seen some extreme examples of this. You know, I think that that's not a typical example. You could also say, well, shoot, man, if you're freaking critical care or pulmonologist or ER doctor, you deserve every ounce of support you've gotten, right? Again, we're not arguing that. We're not saying what is smart and what isn't and what policy should be. I'm just pointing out that like some attendings are getting to pay back like almost nothing. Think about that. Like if you were one of the lucky ones that, you know, became an attending and did everything the right way with your loans, your total payments for your med school might be in like the $20,000 to $30,000 range total. And what if you were a primary care doctor going for PSLF? Let's say you took out $300,000 of debt, same as the classmate you went to that went to brain surgery and your primary care. So let's say you make $150K a year and you have a 3-year residency. How much would you pay back on your loans? The funny thing is it ends up being about the same, about 20% of the total cost, about 65K present value out of 300K borrowed. The reason is because the neurosurgeon only has one big year of payments and the primary care doctor has 6 years of significant but not huge payments because they become an attending much sooner and have that payment updated much sooner. So there's a perverse incentive in PSLF to become a specialist instead of go work at a primary care spot or in a lower income type of field, which is really interesting because yes, we need more specialists, but we probably need more primary care people. The shortages, those are probably more extreme. And yet we've created a loan program that incentivizes the reverse. Now, if you have a debt to income ratio between 1 and 2, you're trying to decide you're going to pay back, you know, probably 50% of what you borrowed or more than that. And so you're trying to figure out, you know, if your cost between going for forgiveness or refinancing is kind of like close by, well, now you have to factor in things like, how do you view debt? What do you think inflation's going to be? What is your risk tolerance? What is your willingness to deal with annoyance from loan servicers and all that kind of stuff? There's a lot of different decisions you have to make. If your debt to income ratio though is below 1, meaning that say you make 100,000, but you have 80,000 of student debt, unless you're a public servant where there's some unique things to look at, you're probably going to have to pay the whole thing back. If you're between debt to income ratio of 1 and 2, the answer is it depends. And if you're at a debt to income ratio above 2 to 1, then you're going for forgiveness. You're going to be paying back a fraction of what you borrowed in most cases. Now, there's a lot of complicating factors, regardless of what your debt to income ratio is. Even if it's clear which path to take, you can still optimize within that path. So you think about what we do with our student loan consults. Basically, we're figuring out what path you should go down, and then we're optimizing within that path to make sure you're doing all the right things. The crazy thing about all this is yes, while the cost of school and has gone up overall, in a lot of cases, the cost of school has not gone up by nearly as much in terms of what you're actually paying because of the super convoluted and screwed up IDR system that we've got. What's really going on is you are still paying for the higher cost of school, but you might be paying a big portion of it indirectly. So you are a student loan borrower and a taxpayer, meaning that your obligation as a student loan borrower might be one category and your taxpayer obligation might be a separate category. So when you're saying, well, you're only paying back 20% of the cost of the education in terms of the cost in today's dollars with these IBR payments that are very low, you're paying back 80% of it as a taxpayer. So that's what everybody chips in and pays. You know, that's sort of a group cost, if you will. Now, you might say it's a smart group cost because maybe the government makes that money back if you're making higher wages because of your education, right? Again, we're not making an argument about what it should be, but it is an interesting thing to think about. If you think about education and how it maybe relates to healthcare, you know, union workers, other workers saw wages stagnate over the past several decades, in part because so much of the potential wage gains that were on the table from productivity gains was going to increases in health insurance costs that employers were covering. And people are getting increased benefits plus pay, but you're not seeing that pay go up because all the money is going into higher premiums for employer-funded health insurance. So I think we could see something like that happen with education, where education spending just continues to grow and grow and grow because it's, in many cases, very inefficient because there's no reward whatsoever for being efficient and being an in-state public university, really, because you're basically, you know, leaving all this money on the table compared to if you go the extremely high-cost, you know, private school type model, which gets twice as much money for producing the same product. So the inefficiency in higher education, barring any reforms, probably continues and gets even worse. And now you're just spending a lot of money that could be spent on other priorities like early childhood education or paid family leave or all these other things that we're talking about doing as a country. Higher spending on inefficiently delivered educational degrees crowds that spending out. Or it causes increased borrowing, which, you know, in theory, reduces private investment. So this is a big long-term problem, but it's probably fixable if you just capped borrowing limits, tried to reward programs that educate people for less money and maybe imposing some costs on schools that educate people that cost more money, maybe like a instead of a salary cap, like a student loan cap kind of model. Maybe like a carbon tax model, right? Where you're, if you're going to charge people a ton of money, maybe you have to pay a luxury tax if you're charging as much money as like an NYU is. I don't know. I'm not a policymaker for a reason, right? What I am is somebody that can help you figure out what is the best way to pay back your student loans and to pay as little as possible. But when factoring in the cost explosion in higher education, what you want to realize is once you're dealing in prices that might make that educational investment not make sense, effectively, the government picks up the tab over and above this debt-to-income ratio of 1 to 1. The government starts picking up almost all of the cost once you're surpassing the cost of, you know, basically the amount of debt that you borrow that's the same as your salary, which is interesting because it basically means it's like you go to the bar and the first two drinks are on you, but then every single drink after that is on the government. And you also have to pay for that group tab. So then everybody has got an incentive to, you know, keep ordering, right? Bad analogy. That's kind of, I don't know if that's indirectly insinuating like educational investment is like ordering booze at a bar. I didn't mean to do that, but, you know, this is a little bit of an entertainment podcast, so I'll leave it in there, right? So what we want to do is minimize the cost and impact that student loans have on your life. And when you think about it, you realize that, I paid a ton of money for my graduate school degree. But the good news is you didn't pay nearly as much as you think you did unless you're paying it all back directly, in which case lock in low interest rates, maybe use the refi ladder strategy where you're doing multiple refinancings and picking up multiple cash bonuses from us and try to minimize the cost that way. I made this point in a recent email newsletter blast. The average mortgage rate in 1981 reached almost 19%. And, you know, when we're talking about our student loan interest rates for refinancing going to go from 3% to 4%, and maybe they reach 4.5%, oh my gosh. Well, you know, that's actually still super low compared to long-term averages. So just consider that. You know, this is coming out kind of on the same day that President Biden's doing his State of the Union address. We'll be watching that to see if there's any tips or sort of things we can figure out from that in terms of a policy perspective. But if what's kind of crazy is once he does that address, we're like 60 days away from repayment starting. And, you know, they've telegraphed the previous extensions of the payment and interest pause about 40 days ahead of time. So by mid-March, you know, if we don't have any news about a payment extension possibly happening, then you pretty much know repayment's going to begin on schedule. And with a lot of the things going on in the world right now, foreign policy is probably going to crowd out a lot of domestic discussion and priorities. So who knows what all happens, but we'll be here for you. Thank you for listening to the Student Loan Planner podcast. I would also, again, highly, highly encourage you, if you want a follow-up plan or if you want an initial student loan plan, schedule one now. We're starting to allow people to book 90 days ahead of time because we're getting so booked up. We're trying to give people flexibility as to what day, what time, and that's why we're trying to make that change. We're getting, I would say, double the usual volume on a weekly basis. But when people thought the interest pause was going to expire back in December, we were getting quadruple the normal bookings, and we don't have an unlimited amount of time on our schedule, which means that all this spot is just getting basically booked further and further and further out. And so if you wait till last second to book a follow-up plan or an initial plan, just know that, you know, it's like kind of like a popular dentist or something that might be booked out. You might be waiting a long time, right? And I want to avoid that where possible. One good note, we do have a couple more consultants coming on board. I'm really excited to have them on board. Their names are James and Sim. So you'll get to meet them on a future podcast episode. I think some of the other consultants want to interview them and introduce them to you. So look out for that. And if you do have private loans, hopefully you've already applied to refinance multiple times during this pandemic with interest rates being all over the place. But I think that the shot for refinancing existing private loans, that window is really closing with the Fed taking off the gas pedal on monetary policy. So definitely apply at studentloanplanner.com/refi if you have existing private loans. And, you know, once we have clarity that they're not going to extend the interest pause, remember you have 30 days to accept an offer on your refinancing. So I would suggest for a lot of people, start applying in like late March, early April, and then you could wait to pull the trigger until you've confirmed that student loan interest has actually started up again beginning of May. So if you have any questions, studentloanplanner.com/voicemail, leave us a message, ask a question for future pod. I'm Travis with Student Loan Planner. Thank you for listening.